Welcome back to Startup Health Now, the podcast where we celebrate the entrepreneurs and the innovators who are transforming health. I'm your host, Logan Plaster. This week on the show, I'm handing over the microphones to two members of our Impact Board and having them interview each other. At one end of the table, we've got Margaret Laws.
Hey, I'm Margaret Laws, President and CEO of Hope Lab and longtime Startup Health enthusiast and advisor.
At the other end of the interview table is Shirley Bergen.
I love the Startup Health advisor and enthusiast. Yeah, I will ride those rails.
Yeah, go ahead, do it.
And I'm Shirley Bergen. I am currently splitting my time between two things. I am a contractor serving as a senior advisor to ARPA-H, and I'm also a senior advisor, strategic advisor for CURE, which is an affiliate with Deerfield Management. It's basically an innovation campus in the heart of New York City.
Wow, see, I'm learning new things about you. I can't believe this. I didn't know you were doing that.
Yes.
The goal of this conversation was simply to hear about the latest projects and passions of two of the most influential and interesting people in health innovation today. In the interview, which took place in person at the Lake Nona Impact Forum in Florida, we cover a range of topics from youth mental health to the role of AI in diagnostics and education to addressing global gaps in the healthcare workforce. Margaret Laws and Shirley Bergen are thought leaders in health innovation, but they're also deeply involved in directing funds towards promising programs. So it will be interesting to see how their curiosities and passions, as played out here, will lead to concrete moves in the future. Enjoy the conversation.
So we're going to talk a little bit about things we're working on that we're excited about right now.
It's a lot, so much. Where to start?
I'll start a little bit with what we've been doing at Hope Lab, which over the past several years, our work at Hope Lab, as you know, has been supporting the mental and emotional well-being of teens and young adults. And the work we're doing at Hope Lab right now focuses kind of in three areas. And the first is we invest in companies in, you know, many of the companies that have emerged over the last 3 to 5 years in the mental health space have focused on teens and young adults. So we've invested in about 20 companies in that space. Really, really interesting array of things from very social and kind of upstream to clinical and more serious mental illness focused. We support young leaders in the youth mental health space. So last year we did the inaugural Young Innovators in Behavioral Health Award, which really exciting group of 30, under 30 young people.
Working. And I was there.
Yeah, and you absolutely were. It was fantastic.
It was amazing.
And then we have a translational research group. So the other thing we're doing is working with researchers and academics around the country who are working in the space of teen, young adult, mental and emotional well-being, doing studies and helping translate that research into the products and services that are being developed for young people. A big focus we have in that area right now is something that came up a bunch at this conference today, which is purpose. So we're working on something called the Purpose Commons that's bringing together the researchers who are really trying to better understand what drives and sparks and supports purpose in young people with people who develop youth development programs and opportunities for young people to connect with and live their purpose.
Which is amazing. Like, I'm just so inspired by her. I've known Margaret for so long now, and I just, like, am in awe of everything she's doing with Hope Lab. I mean, you have opened up the doors for so many conversations that weren't taking place that are absolutely critical if we are going to attack the tsunami of needs associated with mental health starting at the youth demographic. So, I mean, like, just the awards was incredible. I think all of the innovation you're doing is incredible. If, as you think about this, I mean, like, when we were together, what was it? Where were we? Phoenix?
November, Phoenix.
Phoenix, yeah. Right?
Behavioral Health Tech Conference coming up again in Phoenix this November. Really amazing gathering of people from across the industry, government, regulatory, yeah. Entrepreneurs, investors in
probably
health.
The single most important mental health gathering.
Yeah.
I think,
yep,
right?
Yep, yep.
I think about what that represented, and I think about what we're doing in terms of driving solutions forward in mental health, because I think we have a lot of conversations, but where's the real action in terms of the pivot of spending time innovating against this specific demographic? And you guys are leading the charge. Is there anything, like, when you think about November or this past year, because you're about to take a little bit of a sabbatical here, are there any examples of just truly disruptive game changers as it relates to the solutions being put forward for adolescent mental health?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the things that comes up a lot is whether what we need to do is implement the things we already know how to do and we already have, or whether what we need to do is really have disruptive innovation. I think in this case, we need both. But one example that I'll give is a company that we've been investing in and working closely with, Hazel Health, which is providing mental health support in K-12 schools, more than 200 districts around the country, five, I think, entire states. And the game changer for me, having worked in, you know, this healthcare space for more than two decades now, I'm not going to say how long, is really actually getting care to young people, particularly low-income or underserved young people, where they are in school. Mm-hmm. And now that that foundation is laid, I think the opportunity to be able to deliver all kinds of services and mental health support opportunities to young people gets much more affordable. So I think about that a lot. I think about how do we have in place, you know, in communities where people are, the opportunities for them to get peer support, the opportunities for them to get support from a therapist virtually. Mm-hmm. Often, you know, when they just don't have the ability to get to a clinic or get to a hospital. So that would be one, scaling what we know works. Mm-hmm. And then I think on the other side, one of the things I was talking about in a meeting I was at a couple days ago was diagnostics for mental health. And I know that's something you've been thinking about as well, which is how do we get to a place where we can do a much better job of effectively diagnosing mental health conditions, developmental delay conditions in young people so that we can apply the treatments that we know can work.
Yeah, and using the technology that they're growing up with.
Exactly.
I think I think about that a lot, actually. Instead of just the standard kind of patient-reported outcome surveys or, you know, your traditional questions about how you emotionally are feeling, I think this next generation is really interacting with technology in a way that we can use to inform innovation in very different ways, whether it's vocal biomarkers, whether it's, you know, the way in which you're interacting with that technology and the data that it is collecting that you are able to put to work in order to keep you healthy. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity to meet this next generation exactly where they are with the exact technology that they're using every day, right? And making it much more accessible, breaking down the stigma associated. I mean, I love my son's at school right now, and they continue to use the mental health days, right? Mm. This acknowledgement in front that this is a day I need to take for my overall well-being, and that is okay.
Yeah.
So I just think we need to make it, continue to make it accessible, continue to break down the stereotypes, continue to leverage technology that they are comfortable with, and make that technology help them be healthier.
Yeah.
And what does that look like, right?
Well, and one of the things that I'm most excited about, I talked about earlier, is actually working with young people, 18 to 30-year-olds, younger than 18 in some cases, but working with those young people who are developing solutions. Even in research, we're going to release a study in May with Common Sense Media. It'll be the third in a series that we've done. Mm-hmm. And what we did in that study was we actually had young people for the first time working with us to write the questions.
Yeah.
Because we don't actually know, as people in our age cohort, how to ask these questions.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
really bringing young people in who are natives to the technology, as you point out, but who also know how they and other young people talk about their well-being and talk about their mental health.
Yeah.
So bringing them in as true research partners and really working intergenerationally is something we've been really leaning into this past year.
Yeah, it's the normalizing the conversation, right? Normalizing the way in which we think about it, normalizing the way in which we're bringing the important voices to the table, the expertise to the table, the insights they're going to have, much different than us trying to garner it purely from research. So,
and then we have AI. So one of the other things we're thinking about, and I'm curious, I know you're having a lot of AI conversations as you do. We've been thinking about it in a couple of dimensions. One, we have a grants program where we, with 12 other foundations or funders, support young, it's called the Responsible Technology Youth Power Fund. And we do grant support to nonprofits that are started and run by young people or intergenerationally led groups. And there we are this year really looking at what's emerging in the AI space, again, from young people.
Mm-hmm.
Their young people are kind of growing up with and growing into AI, so really interested to see how they're thinking about it, what their perspectives and rhetoric are, and what kinds of things they're building to leverage it. And then we're also thinking, it came up in the AI panel here a little bit earlier, about the ethics of AI. And again, big interest from young people. But what are you seeing around AI and mental health? Is there anything that we should be looking
for? I mean, to me, AI is the collection of that data and putting it to work in order for us to better understand mental health in general. And so I think, you know, I think about AI in the context of education. I think that it is going to be a ubiquitous tool. It's something that you are going to have, you know, a part of the way in which you learn, act, you know, think, play, work. I think like everything is going to be influenced by AI. And I don't think it's like AI in a vacuum. I think there's going to be enormous tools that we can use for our own health. I think there's going to be enormous tools that help us become smarter and more educated on you know, everything from mental health to our overall physical health. I think it informs the decisions we make around our health. I think it gives us access to understanding our health in ways that we haven't had before. So I look at it as this unbelievable moment in time where AI has been around for a long time, but now we're seeing it in this very present, very hands-on, very interactive opportunity, right? And it's going to be involved in every aspect of our life. And I hope it can help us stay healthier.
Well, aren't you sort of fascinated to see what young people do
with
it? I mean, recognizing that there are challenges and perils, there are equity issues, there's lots of things that make this moment in AI challenging. There's also when you get together with young people who are, you know, not quite AI natives, they're a little bit older, but the next group will be, to see the what it's unleashing for them and what it's allowing them to create and think about. So I think they're, you know, I'm not going to be a rabid, not quite as rabid a techno-optimist as some, but I do think what we're really trying to do is listen to young people and really listen to them both about where they see the challenges, the inequities that are being, you know, repeated, the challenges for social media that has led to or you know, created some of the mental and emotional challenges people are facing, and really helping support them as they think about ways to build this next technology sort of platform and world in ways that can reflect their interest in equity, their interest in supporting one another. So
the inclusiveness, the access, they'll probably be much more trustworthy initially. I mean, they're growing up with this technology, so it's a very different way of engaging with it than I think those of us who are still, you know, very much see the promise, but are also very cautious of the potential pitfalls.
Remind me how old your kids are. You said 14?
17.
17.
So, no, I'm sorry. He just turned 18, February 21st. So my youngest is now 18 and my oldest is 20.
So you're seeing it up close and personal.
Yeah, that's why I said education, because like I really feel like, you know, education is probably one of those areas, another, you know, great frontier that needs to be massively disrupted by technology. Yep. And I think AI is going to play a big role in the way this next generation learns. Yep. So I think it, as we think about, you know, mental health, the way in which they learn about themselves, they have all of these different tools at their fingertips that inform them in ways that we could have never imagined. Yeah. And so what kind of doors does that open? What kind of creativity does it inspire? What kind of access to new ways of thinking and new ways of interacting and engaging? I just think there's great promise ahead. I know there are, especially when we talk about you know, health equity and access and the way in which the models are developed to be inclusive and to represent society, absolutely critical if AI is going to be a positive influence on society. And I would love to see it be a positive influence in society as it relates to mental health, an area that you and I have both been unbelievably passionate about. I talked about it actually with Logan last year at Health. Just the opportunities to disrupt this area. And I know we're looking at areas around biomarkers, but I think we also have to look at the way in which that mental health is facilitated today. I've had a lot of conversations lately about, is mental health care going to be successful riding the rails of traditional physical health?
That's a great question. And one of the things that comes up a lot, and it's coming up in every aspect of health, but really in mental health, is workforce.
Yes.
And so as we think about what is the workforce we have, what is the workforce gap we have, what is the workforce we need, what are the new roles that peer supporters and other folks can play in providing some of this upstream mental well-being support? What are the new roles that are needed in schools as more focus on creating healthier schools and well-being focused schools come to play? I think one of the things that I'm going to be spending a little time digging into is really thinking about workforce and you know, how we both meet the needs we have right now, but also create a pipeline that can create, you know, really reimagine some of the kinds of healthcare supporters and you know, workforce that we need as we go into thinking about this a little bit differently.
Yeah, especially when we think about the massive shortage we've had in mental health care. However, we now are
seeing...
Globally,
I mean,
sure.
I was at a meeting a couple of days ago in New York, and it was a global gathering, and a number of different organizations, McKinsey Health Institute and Kokoro and a couple of other organizations coming together to really look globally at how do we support mental health and well-being, recognizing this is really a global challenge. I'm going to call it a crisis, but a global challenge. And we have a much more robust workforce than most of those places do. So.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And what does the next generation of workforce look like in mental health, right? How, going back to your AI, you know, question, how does it influence the change? I mean, I watched, you know, we're at Lake Nona, right? Yeah. And there was the unicorn on stage around nurses and the opportunities to really disrupt the way that workforce is engaging and is able to, you know, kind of in a distributed way, provide support. And you wonder, well, what does that look like across other areas in healthcare, right? I mean, it could be massive. And we, when we think about mental health today, so much of the care happening in the ER when it becomes a crisis instead of the care being preventative. What are those opportunities with the workforce to truly be preventative? How does mental health be incorporated from the very beginning of your care so it's not something that is episodic, right? It's we know that mental health needs to be cared for, you know, consistently. And I actually think like if we are caring for ourselves holistically, then mental health becomes part of that. I don't think you can decouple it. And I think that's why when I think about, like, what does that look like in terms of care of the future? And does mental health need its own, you know, system change? Or can it continue to ride the rails of our traditional physical care system? I don't know. Like, does it require some unique aspects that need to be completely invented from the ground up in order to truly be able to provide the care that's needed, the continued growth of the care that's needed for mental health, especially since it's starting younger and younger, right? We're becoming more aware of it younger and younger. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, and tying back to the AI piece, I think there's a lot of opportunity to inform and then a lot of opportunity to kind of just change the game in terms of how we think about care in general. And I think the more we're talking about it like this, the better.
So we've been talking a lot about mental health. What is something else that you're excited about? Maybe something you saw over this couple of days or something you're working on elsewhere in your time?
In my world. I think like Logan and I had this conversation earlier. I continue to be really passionate about mental health. I continue to be equally as passionate about women's health. And, you know, over the last few months, I've had an opportunity to just become really immersed in understanding the challenges associated with the lack of attention, a lack of funding, a lack of resources towards women's health. I mean, up until, you know, a week ago or so, the largest women's health fund was $73 million.
Yep.
And you think about how long women have been excluded from, you know, opportunities to advance science. You know, you can go back to the clinical trials, but you can also just talk about how much are we investing in understanding women's health. And I'm not talking about just reproductive health, right? I'm talking about women's aging. I'm talking about diagnostics for cancers like cervical cancer and ovarian cancer and uterine cancer. I'm talking about understanding, you know, diseases that disproportionately impact women. Like I love Startup Health's Alzheimer's moonshot, mm-hmm. right? Because we know that women are disproportionately affected by Alzheimer's, and this is a massive opportunity to do research in that area. So I think, this is an area I'm super passionate about and really kind of just like driven for this impact of change right now, and inspired obviously by the First Lady's commitment to women's health research, inspired by ARPA-H's massive commitment to $100 million to advance women's health research. It's time, it's been long overdue. It's a moment in time, it's a moment in history to really advance what is 52% of the population. Has been pretty much left out in terms of much of the research and advancements. And it's time to push those over, in some cases, the starting line, and in other cases, the finish line.
Yeah. Well, I will echo that enthusiasm about women's health, but I will not repeat all that. I will just say the other thing I think, and I think about coming to these conferences year after year and being struck by rhetoric that's changing. And I attended a session today that was on food as medicine and have been in that space peripherally for a long time. And I think the messages we heard today around the number of states that have Medicaid that's now reimbursing for food as a way of treating people with chronic conditions and food-sensitive conditions, and the promise that within 5 years, this will feel normal in the same way that a lot of the other social needs, 5 years ago, we weren't really talking about it. Now we talk about social needs, social determinants of health. I think food as a really important driver of and supporter of health and well-being is something I'm also attuned to, and I feel like hopefully we see a little bit of a turning of the tide.
Yeah, agree. I would say that, yes, I echo that as well. I think the opportunities in nutrition are massive, mm-hmm. And the influence of our food system on our overall well-being and mental health and physical health. So yeah, I'll echo that.
Well, thank you. It's been great to talk with you today. And as always, I really learn from you and enjoy spending time together. So thanks for the inspiration.
This was like an impromptu. Let's get together and spend some time together. I'll do that with you anytime, Margaret.
Thanks for listening to Startup Health Now. We'll be back again with another episode next week.